Welcome to the Bilge Pumps, where a bunch of naval geeks spout off.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Bilge Pumps episode 64, the fractionally late edition, but as it turns out, Providence has allowed us to address a fairly recent topic. So you are joined by the regular crew, myself, Drakin. Myself, Drakinifel, sonar pings coming from Australia in the form of Jamie Zedel, and Dr. Alexander Clark.
Hello.
Yeah, very appropriate because of course, given that the week is the week of the mid-teens of September 2021, we will of course be discussing the latest news about Australia and its submarines. And given the reaction of the, shall we say, French Twitter to the whole thing, I thought it was appropriate to start off with a badly tuned music box.
Okay.
There we go.
How did I know you guys would try and leverage this into the what, 1,000-year-old war or whatever it is?
Yes.
Oh, come on. This was no surprise. We've talked about this on Bilge Pumps many, many times. What the Australians needed was an SSN. That's what they were talking about. All the stats, all the metrics they were looking for an SSN, were requirements for an SSN. But they were trying to get an SSK out of it. And then they went and picked the smallest SSN you can get and tried to convert that into a diesel submarine.
Well, I think the for those of you who are completely unaware of what the heck we're talking about, this is the what to most people has been the rather surprise announcement that Australia is ditching the short fin Barracuda SSK conversion program with France. And they've signed a new defence compact with the US and the UK, which covers a lot of things, actually. It covers things like Tomahawk missiles and surface-to-air missiles and all sorts of other fun things. But the main headline has been that instead of getting this SSK, they're now going to work with the US and the UK on some form of SSN, i.e. a nuclear attack sub.
Yeah, look, it's all a bit of a surprise here as well. You know, for a supposedly Westminster style of open and democratic government, this was just sort of dumped on everybody this morning without any form of forward debate or discussion. You know, very recently we had the Australian Defence Minister explaining in great detail how we didn't have the industrial capacity to support nuclear powered vessels, that we didn't have that generating an entire nuclear industry alongside of a nuclear submarine project would be a dramatic increase in the total cost of the program. And that poor old defence minister has now having to backpedal immensely fast. So exactly, you know, I'm sure that we're going to be...
This sounds actually very Westminster style to me.
So I'm sure that there's going to be an awful lot of interesting times ahead finding out exactly how this was pulled off and also discovering how people will try to cover up the various machinations involved. But the outcome, well, you know, the traditional British-French rivalry aside, I think France has a right to be somewhat surprised and upset, but probably not as surprised and upset as they're making out to be.
Do they? They've been delaying. They've been causing trouble. There have been non-stop problems. SSK program on the Barracuda has been one of the most fraught conversions going.
Yes, but you know, and that's what you know. The issue is, I think, that they oversold their capacity and their capabilities. Mm. And here we are, 6 years into the project, I think, and it's still vaporware when it should really be much further advanced than it is. And you know, our Defence Department, our government has been making delegations and representations about these concerns now for several years. It's also, I think, as we can tell from today's shock, I think it's also been very diplomatic in the way that it's been presenting this problem to both the Australian public and the French public, which has backfired spectacularly now because they reached a crunch point. Produce or shut up. And they've decided, well, clearly you're not going to be able to produce, so we're going to go with Plan B. Now,
which is the old alliance in many ways for Australia.
Well, yes, but you know, we are not the old alliance belongs to an old world, a much less global world, and you know, there are also strategic and diplomatic realities involved here. France has actually got territories right alongside of Australia and around Australia. So France has always been had a Pacific presence. So if you're talking about alliances from an Australian perspective, well, yeah, I mean, it makes much more sense to be currying up to the French than to the British. So,
but you know, I've probably been of the group the one who's been most, to an extent, had it hearing rumours that this was coming. And I have probably, I can think of several conversations in the past where I've discussed rumours I've heard coming, and you guys have probably been sort of thinking, where is he getting this? Because we've been talking about this with the Type 26 programme and Canada, Australia, and Britain getting together for an SSK. And there's been lots of discussions of that going on. And what this seems to have turned into is, well, actually, what Australia needs is not an SSK, they need an SSM. And Britain and America, well, we're already working together on the SSBNs to an extent. We're already working together on our submarine programs to a large extent. We're both looking at future nuclear submarine programs. Australia needs a nuclear submarine. Why don't all three of us combine? And I don't think it will stay a three-headed dog for long. Because I think there is a fourth dog which is going to get involved, and I think that's Canada. I think Canada could join in as well.
Canada's reaction today has not been at all positive, though.
Canada's in the middle of an election. It's not been positive because, in many ways, Trudeau's feeling annoyed because he wasn't included in the discussions. And the reason he wasn't included in discussions is, as far as I know, it's come together very, very quickly. And honestly, they didn't trust Trudeau not to start making noise. Because it's an election going on.
Your least favourite member of the Commonwealth, New Zealand, was involved in those talks. And
I'm not surprised.
Didn't want anything to do with it.
They're not my least favourite, but I understand why New Zealand doesn't want to. Look, I like New Zealand, and I think New Zealand is a great country. I think their government's doing fairly well for New Zealand at the moment, but I do think that they are not prioritising defence enough, and they are preying in hopes on other people's. But I also can understand why for New Zealand this is not a practical option. Because for Australia, what is a reach but doable with a lot of American and British support, which we're happy to give, for New Zealand would be absolutely physically impossible, even with that support. If they're going for a submarine program in a nicest way for New Zealand, I would tell them to go and buy Japanese or German off the shelf and just get used to it.
I don't think it actually meant them operating submarines. I just think it meant them cooperating in the logistics and the training and the support and this massive new industry that I keep referring to that Australia is suddenly going to have to pull out of its back pocket.
I think it all comes down to this. It comes down, I think, to the fact that there is the elephant in the room, which is China, which is effectively kind of the driving force behind all of this. Because even though all the press statements are very careful not to mention China directly, let's face it, we all know this is exactly why this has been done. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the previous traditional security concerns for Australia over the last however many decades, places like Indonesia, you can get away with a long-range SSK for dealing with them. But as we've discussed previously, if you're having to go up to the South China Sea, it was always going to be a stretch, whatever you did, to have a long-term endurance patrol in that kind of operational area. And for that, a nuclear submarine makes a lot more sense. But Australia did a lot of trade with China, still does, even though China's not buying some of it at the moment. Was it steel and iron ore? They don't.
But they've also, you know, things like seafood and wine and things as well. But you know, they haven't the core staples. They're still importing. They're still importing their iron, even though they're complaining about it.
Mm.
They're still importing coal, even though they're complaining about it and making it difficult. I think they have actually stopped the coal imports.
Mm.
Look, you know, we've certainly been the target of some quite blatantly coercive economic tactics. And, you know, again, to be brutally honest, we haven't really had much support from anybody about it. We've been hearing a lot of nice words, but guess where that extra seafood and red meat trade is coming from? The United States.
Mm.
They're quite happy to fill the gap. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
And the same for the other areas that we're getting screwed over. We haven't had the generous pineapple deal that Japan did with Taiwan, which is when China suddenly banned all imports of Taiwanese pineapples. Mm. Japan said, "We'll take the lot, thank you very much." We haven't had that for any of our support. So, you know, again, you know, it's all part of the Game of Thrones. It's all part of the Game of Thrones. You know, poor old Australia getting economically coerced. It's China's whipping boy to demonstrate to the rest of the world what you shouldn't do if you want to be friends with China. And perhaps, you know, perhaps this sudden evaporation of your traditional intellectual property technological transfer regulations is a way of saying, well, here's a way of saying sorry in a way that gives us the money and the advantage.
It's also a way, if you think about it, and I'm going to keep referring to this again, Britain and America were already looking at, and I would argue this was coming. I know lots of people are going to tell me, no, we have independent programs, we're going to do it independence and all these things. And I sat there and went, okay, that's a lovely idea, that's a thing, but we're going to end up working together like we have with the SSBNs. We have produced a lot of stuff jointly with the SSBNs. We know the Americans covet British looks the British sensors and the British sonars and those sort of systems. We know we cover to an extent some of the improvements the Americans made in the reactor support systems, because we have a very good reactor courtesy of Rolls-Royce who do the same reactor for the Americans, but the support systems are different. And we know we cover all these things. If we get getting Australia involved, this is going to sound strange, I am detecting a lot of Liz Truss in this project, which is the new British Foreign Secretary. She does seem to have been involved in this on lots of levels before it's become proud. And the fact that she was announced as Foreign Secretary on the day it was announced is to me no surprise. I'm wondering if she's one of the more trusted ministers in the British government at the moment and has been delivering.
But I think it's...
And I think this is the point. I think this is a good way for all three nations to work together. And I do think in the long term, Canada will probably end up joining in. And depending on what China does, New Zealand might find itself joining in, because New Zealand at the moment is trying to be friends with China because they see that as their best way of trying to manage them. Okay. But if China causes a lot of trouble with the Polynesian and the Micronesian nations and starts causing real ruptures there, then New Zealand might find itself given a choice of either it gives up protecting them as it traditionally has, or it needs to join in with the old five powers and it becomes a five power alliance. I don't think New Zealand will ever get nuclear submarines. I do think they might end up being involved in Type 31 project or Type 32 project.
Yeah, I don't think they've never had subs in their history. I don't think I could be wrong, but I don't think it's pure economics of scale there. You know, it's New Zealand's probably got the economy of one of your cities.
I mean, it's the geopolitics of it is effectively it's the battle lines being drawn. It's gotten to a point, as we pretty much predicted, of people are starting to have to pick sides, and you know, places like Singapore, understandably, and New Zealand are still trying to play sit on the fence. Some nations have gone, you know what, stuff it, we're on China's side. And Australia with this has basically just taken the a very definite stance to say, no, we're not on China's side. And it's I would say
Singapore is being very interesting, saying they're sitting on the fence, and yet they are providing Britain with expanded basing facilities, which are going to be probably be part of this alliance to an extent. They are, and the five power alliance is there's a lot of work being put into the five powers.
If it's all about the Indo-Pacific and the Pacific nations, we've just pissed off one of the biggest players in that region, France.
Well, this is
how really.
And these are people with their boots on the ground and their ships in the water.
Have we really, though? Because honestly, there is a difference between pissing off the French industrial strategy and Macron, with an election going on, getting very, very noisy about it because it's very, very bad, and pissing them off in terms of them not doing something, them not being involved in counterbalancing China. There is a difference in that. It's going to sound strange. This is during an election time again in France. You have to look around this. There are elections going on almost at the moment in Portugal. There's the municipal elections. There are all sorts of elections happening in Europe, that, and all sorts of elections have been delayed by COVID, which are now taking place. And you have to sometimes look at the political rhetoric which comes out, not in terms of the international relations, but in terms of the domestic. And that is what Macron, and that is what everyone is making noise with. And also, here is the point which I find really interesting. There is a debate currently going on as to whether Morrison managed to get through to Macron when he tried to call him. He does seem to have tried to call him, and there seems to be most people seem to agree that Macron didn't make time to talk to him. So in the nicest way, Macron can't complain. If Morrison tried to call to tell you, give you a heads up and explain, this is why we're having to do it in a very diplomatic and nice fashion, and you go, I'm too busy to talk to the Prime Minister of Australia because I'm running an election. And then you say you can't then turn around and say the Prime Minister of Australia has blindsided you. You can't. Well, it's rude.
Well, you can.
I'd just like to point out at this point that the President of the United States couldn't even remember his name.
He did say the guy down under. Yeah.
So currently, the UK is coming out on top because at least we can take phone calls and remember people's names. So you know, minimum bar achieved.
that was quite an interesting video. Have you watched the video of the things come through? Because
a whole lot, but
I did watch it through, and I make fun of Boris Johnson on a regular basis. I might have been a Conservative borough councillor, but I am, as I hope my two colleagues here will testify to, equal rights mockery of all politicians in my country. And I do tend, but I was actually listening to Boris in that thing, thinking, oh my God, he's actually doing this quite well.
He didn't exactly have a massively high bar to clear to look like the most competent man in the room.
No,
but he was educated at Eton, so at some point I think he probably could just switch off and default to his classics course and still sound vaguely competent.
Eton and Oxford, so it does help. But
at that point you'd probably slip into ancient Greek or Latin, and then everyone would wonder if he'd completely lost the plot.
But no, he does good.
So what I want to know is, how do you plan to ship all your nuclear technicians and engineers over to Australia? Are you going to create a reenactment of the First Fleet? Are you going to press gang them? Or how are you actually going to feed this nuclear
beast? Here's the actual disturbing thing, Jamie. About a quarter of the nuclear technicians I know in the UK are actually Australian. There's just no industry for them to work at in Australia.
Yeah. I have a feeling that the way this is probably going to work, and I've been giving this some thought, trying to work out, because I think it's all tied into the nature of what this SSN is going to be. Is it going to be a whole cloth design? I doubt it, because that's going to take forever and cost an awful lot of money. Mm-hmm. So it's probably going to be a minimally adapted existing design.
You mean like the French one?
Which is
we're not going to be sticking diesel engines in a nuke. But... I have a feeling that
I bet you that we'll probably find some way to work in a requirement for it to carry helicopters.
Wouldn't surprise me.
The question is going to be whether you use the Virginia or the Astute as the base model.
And this is the thing. Looking at the various US export restrictions, what they're happy to export, what they're not. Bearing in mind that the Collins class at the moment and the attack class as planned were both using US computer, fire control computer, and combat systems, and U.S. weapons. Albeit that I think the Collins used
use of weapons. Culture Series Book 3 by
Shut up, computer. Computer, silence. Okay, apparently my Alexa decided I wanted to know about weaponry. Never mind.
Well, so, if anyone here did need to learn from the computer, it's probably you, Drake, isn't it?
So, yeah, but that, you know, I'm thinking that therefore the US is not going to have a problem with continuing that trend. You know, combat systems, weaponry, that kind of stuff. Sonar, sensors, etc. They're probably not going to have a problem exporting that, especially to Australia. But we know Congress does tend to be very, very picky about exporting actual, if you like, hulls. It's one of the reasons why they're picky about who gets the F-35. One of the reasons they never wanted to export the F-22. The reason a lot of the Abrams models are massively downgraded. You can buy the fire control systems and the gun for an Abrams quite happily. If you're a US ally, they'll sell that to you, but good luck getting a full spec, full model M1 tank, unless you happen to be a very, very select group of nations.
Basically the UK,
but the
only one which could probably could qualify for that.
The UK is almost the other way around. We don't mind selling people hulls, but we're a little bit more picky about the actual systems themselves. As Dr. Clark mentioned earlier, the US would absolutely love it to get its hand on the Astute sonar suite.
They would have to pay us a lot more money than they're currently offering.
But I think
Australia just tends to hand it over for free, like when we invented effective acoustic tiles.
We learned that with the Harrier. We now charge lots.
But I think probably the thing that makes the most sense to me at the moment would probably be to take an Astute hull, possibly hull and reactor system, and just replace the combat system and sonar suite, etc., with US tech, which would also make sense in terms of it being a tri-nation agreement, because we're probably not quite so precious about selling the Australians Astute hulls, but we probably don't want anyone else to get our sonar, whereas the US seems quite happy to send their fire control and sonar systems overseas to Australia. But I suspect Congress will probably throw a little bit of a fit over a Virginia Block 4 or Block 5. The other thing is that when you look at the Barrow and Furnace Yards at BAE, they historically got up to a maximum of about 5 to 6 subs in the mid to late 2010s. They had 5 to 6 subs between the Astutes and the Dreadnoughts going on. Now they're down to 4. They've got two Astutes, and I think it's Agamemnon and Audacious are there, and obviously Dreadnought and Valiant under construction. So they've got at least one, possibly two, free slots. And Agamemnon is probably due for launch at some point relatively soon.
She's been due for launch for about the last 6 to 8 months, but yes.
Which will take it down to 3. Now, obviously, once they lay down Spike, that might bring the specs up to 4 again. But Agincourt is the last Astute that's on the book, so there's not going to be any more Astute hulls laid down for the Royal Navy than the
officially.
Officially,
there has been rumours that with our commitments to the Far East and South China Sea, it's either speed up building a next generation SSN or build a batch free Astute.
But my point is, at the moment, Barrow and Furnace in theory has at least one or two slots free to start building hulls. And that comes round to kind of what Jamie was saying, like, where's the industry going? Because Australia doesn't have an industry to build a nuclear sub.
Yes. You see, this is the thing. The key to the deal is still building them here. They still want to build 8, which I think is one more than what you guys have got. Gee, you're slipping in the United Kingdom.
Well, I did just say, the nicest way, we are looking at theoretically, discussion.
It's still theoretically, you know, they want to build them here in Adelaide, or at least they're going to say that until after the next federal election here in Australia, which is early next year.
Here is how the industry might work, and this is going to sound strange. While you're building the yard to build them, the first one, or maybe the first two, might be built in the UK with your people coming over here and learning in our yard how to build them. That would be how the exchange would. And then the rest...
That makes way too much sense, which is why there's no way it's going to happen.
Yes, I think actually the balance between physically possible but also hilariously nonsensical, and possibly quite amusing, is likely to be that whilst the yard is under construction, yes, you'll have some Australian people at Barrow and Furness learning how to build astutes, but I suspect that rather than build them entirely in the UK, what they'll probably do is the same way you get made in the UK or made in Australia or made in the USA slapped on a lot of things. They'll, because we know, like with pretty much everything else the Royal Navy has these days, everything's built in module sections. So I suspect what might happen is that they will build, so maybe the first couple, build the module sections, wrap them all up in giant tarps, stick them on a freighter, ship them all the way to Australia, and they arrive as kind of a giant high technology underwater IKEA set. And then the nascent Australian shipyard, which hopefully should have a basic capability up by that point, basically just has to bolt them together.
Yeah.
And then they can slap a Made in Australia sticker on it, and everybody's happy until
They did something like that with the Canberras. The raw hulls were built in Spain and shipped over to Australia, where the islands and the internal fit out was done. But which is, you know, again, it helps build up that industry. But then, of course, it probably all fell. Well, not true, because after that, they still had the destroyers. Well, air warfare frigates underway, but you know it's sustainment. You've got to keep these skills in operation.
Well, the nicest way to get 8 nuke subs, you're going to take a lot longer. You're going to keep that skills going for a while.
The other
thing, once you've got them in service, they require a lot more maintenance in terms of you need to take them in and look at them properly.
The other advantage of doing it that way, though, is that with ITAR, it will probably help smooth things over, because if you ship submarine module blocks over to Australia, then all the electronics, the sonar, the weapon systems, the fire control systems, etc., all of that stuff, that can then be shipped from the US straight to Australia and fitted at the Australian yards. And thus, in terms of the ITAR regulations, they don't have to involve a third party. They don't have to say, okay, well, we're selling this, I know, the combat system, we're selling this to Australia, but first it has to go to the UK, and then the UK will install it, and then they'll deliver it to Australia, which again might cause problems. It's much simpler to just say, right, well, you know, the conning tower from section of whatever frame to frame it is, this module gets built in the UK without a combat system, gets shipped to Australia, we ship a combat system to Australia, we put it in there, and then we bolt all the bits together and call it a submarine.
But as you were saying just a minute ago, Dr. Clark, these submarines require a certain degree of maintenance, which requires a certain degree of skills. Mm.
Which requires a certain degree of industry to be maintained in Australia. And this is actually a very sensible point for Britain and America, because up to my, we've been talking about the money in terms of the contracts they're going to get, that's the advantage, but we haven't talked about what the strategic advantage for it is. And here is the big strategic advantage. America and Britain pretty much use their submarine facilities interchangeably. You will get American submarines, even freaking SSBNs, the big ones which carry the nukes, going in and out of British ports from America, and British ones going in and out of American ports. If they need help, or if they need a repair, there's a program on about a T-class submarine at the moment on Channel 5. It had a fire on board, it had an issue, it could have gone to an American port if it needed to. These are all things. Australia is going to be included in that network now. And that is the big advantage for Britain and America. When it comes to the South China Sea, when it comes to facing off against China and managing that threat, you suddenly are going to have a secure nest of technologies which is going to have the facilities. And actually, the British and the American boats coming there is going to help maintain the Australian systems there, because it's going to provide a level of critical mass and experience of maintenance. It's also going to mean they're going to be British and American engineers there alongside their Australian counterparts, and Australian engineers are probably going to be invited to American and British ports to work with them in their places as well.
I think it ties into the geostrategic issues, because with Australia very firmly taking its camp in kind of the Western Hemisphere, this planting its feet saying we're in this camp, one, it it cements obviously the diplomatic ties between the Western powers, but it also means that, as I'm sure Jamie will appreciate, it does kind of paint a bit more of a bigger target on Australia's back from as far as China is concerned. And the way you counter that is, well, we know that the US and the UK have been looking for basing opportunities out in the Western Pacific as much as they can. That's why we've got this agreement with Singapore. It's why the US has kept its bases in Japan. But it, from a lot of perspectives, it having a base in Australia would also be very helpful. And with this kind of cooperation, you know, the attack program was looking to be about 80-90 billion Australian dollars, which is approximately 40-45 billion pounds sterling. The cost of apart from the first one, the cost of a astute is about 1.5 billion pounds. So even if you added another $500 million onto that for integration issues, etc., for US systems, you're still looking about 2 billion a sub. So for 8 subs, that's 16 billion. So there's a big gap between 16 and 40-45. And obviously a lot of that was going to be technology transfer, systems, upgrades, shipyards, etc., with the attack program. But it means that now that sort of multiple tens of billions of pounds, or twice that in Australian dollars, is available. Obviously, some of that is going to have to go into shipyard construction and so forth and facilities, the same it was with the attack class. But I suspect that somewhere, either in the fine print or in a follow-on agreement, there's probably going to be something along the lines of either expansion to or construction of a brand new submarine and naval base in Australia. Who knows, maybe even we'll go back to Darwin.
I wouldn't be surprised if it goes back to Darwin.
It's too shallow up there for subs.
Yeah.
I think it's that's not really prime submarine water. And this is one of the, and this has been part of the Australian submarine debate for decades. Where do we need our subs to operate? Deep blue green sea or shallow brown archipelagos?
Well, you know, there is part of me which is, it would not be surprised if at some point Australia ends up with a fleet of 8 SSKs for one coast and 8 SSNs operating on the other coast. I really wouldn't be surprised about Australia ending up having to go that route, because the whole problem has been trying, as you've been pointing out, to go deal with the issue of Australia's coastlines and their seas. And the fact you have waters which are far more suited to SSKs on one side, and then around those waters and on the other side, on the other coast of Australia, it's far more SSN friendly. And it is almost the case of, you almost need a fleet of SSNs on one coast and a fleet of SSKs on the other coast. And that is how you defend Australia.
I'm not sure even Great Britain would be able to afford that. So no. In the meantime, we have to go with what
to be fair, we probably could if we actually bothered to pay, if we were actually going to pay for it. This is the point, you know, if you look at Britain at the moment, if you consider the amount of money we're spending on the NHS, which you need to spend in a pandemic, and I'm not disagreeing of total sort of, but when we need to spend money, we can find the money. It's the thing is, but, it's persuading us we need to spend the money.
So just getting back to the subs. So what are the strategic implications of going SSN? Does this mean that we are now no longer going planning on contesting the shallow South China Sea, and that we're just going to attempt to bottle up those choke points?
The other thing in the treaty. Have you, if you go read through it, what's the other thing the Australians and USN and the British and the Americans are sharing technology on?
Missiles.
No, the XLUV, the extra large uncrewed undersea vehicles,
right,
which, as I've been saying for a while, are basically the British and American, we're buying an SSK, but we can't call an SSK because that'll put our nuclear submarine programs in jeopardy, because that'll mean members of parliament will think that they can delete a nuclear sub and just replace it with a diesel sub and they'll get the same thing for a lot cheaper. They can't do that, so they're developing these, and I have a feeling that is going to be your second submarine squadron for Australia. I have a feeling that either they're going to be some British-based ones there or American-based ones, or they're actually, Australia's going to buy some themselves and say, this is part of the SSN you know,
I think we've already announced interest in the Orca program, which isn't quite the same, but it's still in that same league.
And I think that's what it's going to be. I think in the nicest way, that's what the bottle up tactic's going to be. And it's going to be a case of those on the closer waters with the SSNs adding a further layer. And in many ways, this is a reaction to development of hypersonic missiles. This is a reason that you need to push out your defensive layers further. In order, you need distance to make up for the time.
And well, the thing is,
I think that's where the SSNs are coming in.
If you get what I suspect will happen, which will be a lot closer integration and work with the Royal Navy and the US Navy, I suspect some of the issues with, you know, how do you secure coastal Australian waters will probably come and be resolved in the form of an increased presence of maritime patrol aircraft. And various anti-submarine warfare assets, the surface anti-submarine warfare assets, because it is a shift, but it's a shift. It's a weird one because an SSK that's more able to operate in shallow water is great for Australian coastal defence, and in theory, it's good for operating up close and personal with the Chinese. With the sole caveat of it's very difficult to actually get one with a range to go there.
Yes.
Which limits an SSK thing to primarily a defensive stand, whereas an SSN is very definitely an offensive weapons platform, which it pushes your security cordon further out, but then you have to have something else to take up that close range cordon. And I think that's probably going to be a combination of surface vessels and maritime patrol aircraft, because yeah, Australia's got its fleet and its air force to do that job, but there's a limited number of them. And if the SSNs are going out up front, there'll probably be some surface elements going out up there as well. But if you've now got a joint basing and you've got US and British contingents there as well, then there's a force multiplier, because we don't, like, however many P8s we've got on order, if we keep two or three back to keep an eye on the Russians, but we deploy a couple to Australia and the US brings a quartet or something, then all of a sudden there's a lot more overall allied maritime. And it also increases, it's not like people trying to do favours for each other. It's the fact that if Australia is now kind of the major southern strong point for allied assets in any potential conflict with China, it's kind of like World War II, where it's also in our national interests to defend and secure Australian waters. Because let's face it, we've done this whole thing before in terms of Australia being the big base for a big Western Pacific conflict against a power that has a border with the South China Sea. This has all been done before.
And I think you also have to think about it in terms of, at the moment in Britain, there are some very interesting discussions going on about the future of the Chief Defence Staff, who that's going to be, and all sorts of things. And there are interesting discussions about the future of the Navy, which we're going to get onto probably after Jamie has left us, because Jamie has very kindly popped into us, but he's very busy this week. And the thing that I'm getting is, I know health and social services are to an extent ring fenced by British funding at the moment, and they're looking at the funding scenarios. But the fence is being increasingly ring fenced, in that they are increasing. And one of the interesting things, there has been a reshuffle in the UK. Usually a reshuffle, the thing that you can guarantee is going to get changed is the defence secretary, because they are always constantly changing.
We've had a ridiculous number here ourselves, I think six years or something like that.
It's been practically the first reshuffle in memory where the Defence Secretary has survived intact, and there was no rumours, no discussions of him moving at all. Ben Wallace is in post and is going to stay there. And it's almost like Britain's taking a more serious approach to the defence at the moment, because they're having to. They've all these countries, America, in a nice way, even when they were running Afghanistan, I would say were not taking a serious approach to defence, because they didn't think they needed to. Everyone thought you were going to be doing counterinsurgency or fighting people who were so weak you didn't have to bother about the years. So defence just became something you could cycle through. You could put someone in and it was fine.
So a quick question.
And now they're now with China rising up and all the other issues, they're suddenly going, hang on, this is something we actually have to pay attention to. Defence Secretary actually matters. Defence actually matters. We want to do deterrence. Deterrence is a lot cheaper than war. And that's the thing, is they realise that. And if you consider, the one example I have is the amount of times I walk around the UK at the moment. And yes, the 40th anniversary of the Falklands is coming up. But the amount of times I hear people saying the point, if we'd had a decent deterrent force available, or we'd had the Queen Elizabeth's, or we had a decent garrison in the Falklands, we would have never had to fight that war. And the amount of money that would have saved.
And lives.
Yes, lives matter. And don't get me wrong, lives matter. But the trouble is, when you're talking with accountants in the Treasury, they tend to care more about the money.
So and I've got to go shortly. I'll have to go shortly, but so I'll leave you. I'll ask you one question and I'll leave you with a challenge. How many nuclear technicians does your average SSN need?
The true answer is probably classified, but I'm going to guess you probably want, well, it's depending on how many watches you're standing, but I'm guessing you probably will need at least half a dozen. If you're standing a two watch system, you're going to want at least two on duty at any one time, plus a backup somewhere that's not the reactor. So that would mean six. I suppose if you're doing three watches, you might get away with two, two, and two. So at least half a dozen would be my guess.
I would, and I'm not going to say the reason I am doing this, but I'm going to say this. I would treble that number in terms of what you usually would probably want, just in case, because there's, if you do have issues, you need to be able to get a far larger team in there.
Oh yeah, this is minimal.
Let's just round it off to 20.
Okay? Yeah, you need about 20, and you need then same number ashore for the next crew, and then you need probably the same number in training. So for each ship, you probably need about 60.
Yeah, you need about 60 by 8.
Yeah.
480.
You're looking at a good 500 or so personnel plus experts training them.
Although only some of them would be the full.
How do we get the 500 people that are directly related to the submarines, plus however many hundreds more are necessary in the background support mechanisms? How does Australia get that from zero to 500/1,000 in the space of 15 years?
Well, in the nicest way, you jump on the programs, don't you?
I suspect
jump
some
on the US
and British
firms. Sorry.
Well, some of it is going to be like, you know, Australian and other submarine crew, they show up for the Perisher course in the UK to learn command.
Mm-hmm.
I suspect it'll probably be a very similar thing with the Astutes and the Dreadnoughts, at least. I don't know quite how much the Americans will be willing to share, but given the Perisher course exists and given that, you know, we've had in the past previous close cooperation between the various Royal insert nation here navies, I suspect having Australian officers and men aboard British subs will probably become a fairly commonplace thing in the near future.
The trouble is Britain doesn't, and Britain needs a certain number of spaces for our own people to train our own critical mass. That's the problem.
But we already do that with our Collins crews for operations. Yeah. I'm talking about the specifics of maintaining that rather delicate and clunky beast called a nuclear reactor.
Yeah, so you have the training on the nukes, but on the nuclear reactors. But I see, my suspicion would be, and I don't know Australian internal politics as well as Jamie does, but my suspicion would be that at some point in the next, let's say, 6 to 8 months, there'll probably be a separate announcement, probably couched in terms of we want to go green, we want to save the planet, etc., all that happy stuff, which will probably announce some form of Australian civilian nuclear reactor, nuclear power plant program.
Yeah.
I suspect that they're keeping that one for after the federal election.
Yeah. We're going to reduce emissions, we're going to cut our carbon footprint, and we don't want to, it'll be something like that, and we don't want to disturb sacred Aboriginal lands with solar plants and etc.
The only way you'll get that past our National Party, which is in coalition with the Liberal Party, is discovering how to use coal as a substitute for uranium. So with that note on the state of Australia,
there is one little thing for that one. I would say watch out for the Rolls-Royce's small reactor program, their small reactors, they've got these small modular reactor systems they've been trying to have for years. It's just now clicked in my head that for the last few weeks, a lot of their literature that's come out, I've been wondering what looked strange about the images they were showing, these CGI-generated images they had of these places being built. It didn't look like Britain. It looks like Australia. It looks like how a British person would imagine Australia. There isn't a kangaroo or anything, or a koala bear in there, or anything like that. But it's just
spiders and snakes.
It's the colours, if you know what I mean. It doesn't look like British countryside. It looks like the colours of Australian countryside.
Yes. We'll find out, and we'll have to ponder on how to use coal in a nuclear reactor. I'm sure we can come up with some way.
Couldn't you use it as some form of insulation?
I'll have to go. Sorry, guys.
Okay.
Right. See you later.
All right. And with Jamie going, this leads us to our next two topics of conversation, which are, well, the Royal Navy has finally flipped. That was the diagnosis of Wilfred Owen when he sent this to me and went, what has happened to the Royal Navy? Why are they saying this? And this is because of the announcements at DESI, which have been interesting, to say the least, but mainly seem to come along with the idea of what I would call buzzword soup. There is a lot of buzzword soup going on. And the DESI pronouncements come combined with some other engineering stuff, which looks really quite cool. Because there's one side of me which is, you know, really quite looking at it going, this looks cool, this looks good stuff. I'm enjoying the ideas coming out. This is something I think is a good idea. And then there's stuff which is they're working with engineers. And then there is other stuff coming out which sounds suspiciously to me like stuff from the beginning of the LCS program, and that's worrying me. Let me just get this out, this lovely article, and read this line of. Okay. Can I find the article which I sent you guys? This is always the trouble. So, what do you think from what you said?
Well, I've been looking at. I have a feeling that some of this is actually a gigantic psychological mind game.
There is always that possibility, but is it to wind up the I've got it now.
It's the Royal Navy. Let's face it, they spent most of World War II playing psychological mind games with people they weren't actively shooting at the time. They're very good at it. And when you look at the full range of the article, I have a feeling this is kind of one of those things of there's some stuff we want to explore in this. So we're going to put it out there, but we don't want everyone to guess exactly which bits are which, so we're going to throw in a bunch of other stuff as well on the basis that either everyone's going to be completely terrified because apparently we're now living in the 24th century and we have Star Trek technology, or they're going to dismiss the whole thing as a bunch of rubbish, and therefore then either way they're not actually going to realize what we're going to do.
Here's the thing. James Parkin is actually a very smart, very cool guy. I've met him on a couple of occasions. Really smart, really cool. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, the saying what you're saying about there being a possible, you know, psychops operation. Let's listen to this phraseology. This is the article in Defence News. The UK Royal Navy wants a future fleet with its sensors and weapons disaggregated and its ships flexible enough to change missions as needed, as the service acknowledges the traditional technology superiority may not be possible in the coming decades. Rear Admiral James Parkin, director developer of the Royal Navy, said the Navy of the next will derive its operational advantage from a system of systems approach that nets together disaggregated sensors, thinkers and shooters in a way that creates more persistent effects and less vulnerability to attack. You listen to that and you just go,
someone threw a dictionary at a wall and then took a shotgun to it and picked up the debris and pasted it together into a press statement.
It sounds amazing until you sort of go into it and go, you are either winding someone up or you are absolutely just. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, but the thing is, if you look at some of this, like some of this stuff that they're that they're talking about, I'm looking at the four main slides they released, is eminently sensible. Okay, so you've got I must admit, some of it is just hilarious as well. You've got this kind of trimaran drone mothership concept.
Oh yeah, that just looks
that is very nice.
Yes,
it's absolutely. It's like a lot of it. I mean, of course, I'd say that a lot of it reflects some principles of what we've been saying. You know, the fact I love trimarans, you love drone motherships, and someone's decided to stick a laser weapon on it for no apparent reason,
just to make you and I happy.
Yeah, but yeah. So that kind of thing, I can definitely see being in the future, especially with what we were talking about earlier with Australia and, you know, unmanned vessels. It's a great force multiplier. Okay, so this I can fully see being a next generation support system.
It's also got the, you know, it's got the whole Zumwalt style ram bow, which tumble home ram bow, which, as you know, I find very, very lovely at this current time.
Yeah,
you know, it does look good. It does look good.
But then on the other hand, the next slide is hex blocks with propulsion vents which can chain themselves together to form new units and are launched from something which, and I quote from the slide, mothership is vaguely streamlined in shape with a brain coral outer skin, and the flipping thing looks like something I was gonna say out of Interstellar, but even Interstellar's ships weren't this advanced. This looks like something out of like Farscape, maybe the Vorlons or the Mon Calamari. It is, and the hexapod modular system building their own ships. That we know where this has come from. That's the Zindi from Star Trek Enterprise. So this slide is basically, what if we threw together about six major sci-fi franchises and then started singing Under the Sea from The Little Mermaid? It's completely off the wall nonsense, which either means it's a massive psyops operation to completely confuse the heck out of people, in which case congratulations, you have succeeded, or quite possibly they actually have a sentient brain coral submarine out there somewhere, and this is their way of trying to disclose it to us before it rises up and kills us all.
This is, of course, the Royal Navy, which, as we said in the past, doesn't have a habit of only announcing things when they're fairly certain. They talk in vague, vague terms, and then suddenly the real thing appears and all of us are going, sods. Sods.
And then you've got this catamaran carrier, which appears to subsist on, I'm guessing from the looks of it, feeding on krill like a baleen whale, given the stuff that's hanging between the hulls, ostensibly looks like it has some kind of pop-up wind turbine system to keep it going, runs on biofuel, and has what actually is possibly the only sane part of this slide is the drone system, which is basically it looks like a quadrotor mother unit, which I guess has all the expensive processing and computational capabilities, and then this rather interesting stingray looking Don't Tell Steve Irwin craft, which is simultaneously both aircraft but can also make itself into a gigantic munition, at which point the brain of it just pops out and goes, I'm out of here, I'm heading back to the mothership for another one. That last element, the drone, again, I can see that being somewhat sensible. Because let's face it, we know that even when you're talking about things like modern missiles, cruise missiles, etc., the expensive part is the electronics. You know, the rocket motor, the metal tube, or now trapezoid, whatever they're using these days, and the pack of explosives, that really isn't that expensive. You can put that together for a few thousand pounds, maybe a few tens of thousands if you want it to go a particularly long way. It's all the complex electronics that costs a lot of money. So the idea of an unmanned aircraft that can optionally turn itself into a munition, but all the expensive electronics can jettison and head back for the carrier, that simultaneously allows for much cheaper and much greater capability. So this, that much I like. I'm also not so sure about why this baleen feeding carrier has a bunch of, I love it, VLS tubes, launch, vertical launch from silo tubes, including satellites manufactured on board. I do hate to break it to, I mean, again, I understand it from a science perspective, but I do hate to break it to whoever came up with that idea. You're effectively saying, if we're going to include missiles that can put satellites into orbit, you're effectively including ballistic missile capability on a carrier, which means the minute you launch any one of those things, you're probably going to end up starting World War III.
Yeah,
difference between a satellite launcher and a
Jamie's probably going to say, if Jamie was here, Jamie would say that it probably is to launch microsats. It's to launch microsats. It's microsats.
Still going into orbit, as far as everyone else is concerned.
Yes, I know, but it's a micro. I'm just enjoying the fact that the modular life support habitability pods enable humans to enter the platform. We sure it's humans on this ship? Are we sure? Can someone please check?
Well, it says, well, we've got quantum sensing devices around the vessel, so that puts it at least like Star Trek First Contact, Star Trek Insurrection, Star Trek Nemesis level of technology. Because, well, you know,
quantum torpedoes. Quantum torpedoes come after photonic torpedoes. Yes,
that's Next Generation movie or late Deep Space Nine. You know, otherwise, if it was main spec Deep Space Nine, early 24th century, it'd be photon sensing devices, not quantum.
Yeah.
And then you've got stations for RF weapons. Okay, that's fair enough. Laser, hologram projections, and rail guns. So now we're on to either the Eldar from Warhammer 40K or possibly the Minbari with holo projections. I suppose actually, that, again, Star Trek Insurrection, they did have the holo ship. So, and this even looks like that thing. I mean, much as I've tried to expunge Star Trek Insurrection from my memory, this thing does kind of look like the Federation holo ship. So, and then, of course, you have the final one. The honestly, Gov, we weren't kidding, UFOs are now real. AKA the giant floating helium frisbee in as a very interesting way to try and get around the orbital weapons treaty ban. It's like, no, we're not putting it in space, we're putting it in the upper stratosphere.
What I love is this is the future fleet. Yes. Not the future Royal Air Force. So this is obviously the Royal Navy announcing that yes, we are going to be the Royal Space Navy. Don't worry, everyone. We are not going to leave this to the Royal Air Force. We don't trust them. It'll be the Royal Space Navy. Don't worry, you'll be fine.
There's a water surface skimming projectile launched from forward facing rail guns, which looks like a giant frisbee, which is going to be interesting. And then this.
Am I the only one who thinks the fighters look like they are from Battlestar Galactica?
Yeah, they're basically Vipers without the upper fin. And no people aboard, because whatever. But see, the other thing I love about this absolutely crazy idea. So effectively, you've got an orbital weapons platform that's just this side of not orbital enough to fit the purpose of the outer space treaties, but is a solar-powered helium balloon floating in the upper stratosphere. And then you've got these honestly not unmanned Viper fighters craft, Governor, hanging from it like a bunch of either rods from God or possibly looking a little bit like the orbital defense satellites from Babylon 5. And then they've got these effectively shuriken surface skimming munitions. And the extra bit, which I find hilarious, is if you look at this their attack profile stage. So I've got stage one, free fall, engine boost craft to hypersonic speed for fast response. Okay, well, that's easy enough from the upper stratosphere. Then it glides in. Then somehow it transitions from hypersonic speeds to, so it's a hypersonic suborbital fighter, unmanned fighter craft that somehow transitions Thunderbird, I don't know, even Thunderbird 2 can't do this, into a submerged stealth craft. So it's underwater as well.
Thunderbird 4
is the underwater one.
There was a movie a few years ago which did have the Royal Navy having fighters which could transform into submarines. And it was terrible. It had Angelina Jolie as the leader of the British Air Wing.
Okay, well, that would be why I either haven't seen it or I've burned it so completely from my memory I have no idea what you're talking about. But yeah, so you've got this stage three. It's going into its submerged form and then launching a multi-role intelligence swarm that's launched for targeting an attack. So
it's presumably going fly my pretties from its munitions bays just before it becomes an underwater jet fighter. Okay, fine. And then it pops up for the stage four strike, whereupon it appears to have both shields and laser or phaser weaponry. Now, I'm sorry, but if at some point we have a submersible hypersonic fighter with surface skimming intelligent munitions, like electromagnetic shields and a laser beam, I think we win. Forget everything else. I think that's just you know, okay, this we've gone full on Star Trek, Star Wars technology. We just win everything all the time, because what the heck are you supposed to do against this? You shoot missiles at it, it'll go underwater. You shoot torpedoes at it, it'll pop up. You shoot CIWS at it, it's just going to go, ha ha, I have shields. Shields down to 90%, Captain, and a console somewhere will explode. But there's no people on board to kill from that. And then it unleashes the firepower of this fully armed and operational battle station at the enemy frigate. It's
the movie that I was Sky Captain and the World of Tomorrow.
Oh dear. Okay.
Yeah, 2004. Oh,
now you've reminded me of that. Only a bottle of Iron Brew.
That's not a bottle of Iron Brew. That's me having a bottle of Iron Brew. You a bottle of whiskey, and we watch it together and live tweet our reactions to it.
Yeah. So far, out of the four, I think there's about out of the four slides, there's probably about 1.5 pages of stuff that's. Makes a lot of sense and is probably semi-realistic for the next 15, 20, maybe 30 years. And then 2.5 pages of, some serious sci-fi franchise copyright violation going on.
You know, this is all done. And then there's the practical stuff, which they're announcing now, which is the Neural Navy pot of planes is aiming to modularize the fleet with payloads and capabilities. There's part of me going, this is not new. The entire Type 26, Type 31 programs have included the idea of modules being added and pods being added. So why this is suddenly news in 2021 when this has been part of the program since they began and has been announced as part of the program since they began, I do not know. But what they've done is this, rather than design modularity in, we have chosen to design it out. These Navy pods will be bespoke containers housing new ways of delivery in mine hunting, survey, air systems, communications, lethality, medical, and more. This means all platforms have the ability to become upgradable with the arrival of a new module. Okay. I think what the British have done, and it took me a while to figure this one out, is instead of having to have a pod which can plug and play with all these systems like the Americans have done, they've almost gone the Stanflex route, although they've gone one step further. The pods literally arrive on the ship, and all they plug into are perhaps the sensor feeds, the CIC, connect to a display in the CIC, and the power supply. Otherwise, you don't need to plug. You just need to anchor them in place and plug them in. Otherwise, they have no other connection to the systems. And if you think about that, if that's what you're tailoring into the systems, then that's a fairly easy pod to do, because after you have those three points of connectivity, everything else is self-contained within the pod. Everything else is the pod. And it literally becomes plug and play. And it was rather interesting. It was confusing me. I was looking at it going, what are they talking about? Because, you know, we assort modularity as the nirvana of capability, flexibility. But I've never been able to afford it. I'm going, well, no, you could have afforded it. You could have bought the Stanflex system, but you chose not to. Now, what you've basically done is gone, well, we don't want modular weapons because that sounds, frankly, absurd. But We are going to announce that we are now going to be nicking more 20-foot ISO containers off the open market. So we're going to be causing even more supply issues for people trying to get stuff printed and sent around the world. And we're going to use these ISOs on our Type 26 frigates, Type 31s, our amphibious ships, offshore patrol vessels, auxiliary ships, and future commando forces, and I'm so sure, in order to provide operational options. And this all makes sense to me. And then you look at the first one produced and shown, and pretty much it's a 3D printing lab storage area for UAVs, quadcopter UAVs. And you go, yeah, that makes sense. And it's actually called, if you read it, Quad 4 or Quo 4.
Hmm.
And there are quadcopters in there. So it's literally called the and this is, I'll make sure you have the same article I'm looking at. And there will be a link to this article and one of the other Royal Navy articles and the Twitter feed in the below on the description of the podcast. Sorry. Brain dying slowly.
Well, and coming back to those futuristic concepts, just so people are aware
that you are just obsessed with those futuristic combats. You want to figure out which sci-fi each one's come from, don't you?
Well, it says the article says young engineers from industry and academia responded to the challenge posed by the UK Naval Engineering Science and Technology Forum, and then you've got Roussi. One of the research fellows there says some of the proposals are eminently rational, which is worrying.
Roussi. Don't take this the wrong way. I love him dearly, but that's Roussi.
But he also says, but some of the others are much more in the realm of very, very speculative thinking. Okay, slight semblance of rationality. And then you have one of the Royal Navy admirals saying the young engineers who worked on this project are thinking radically and with real imagination, and reflects how the Royal Navy is thinking too. Now, okay, the idea of the Royal Navy wanting orbital defense platforms with submersible hypersonic attack vessels, and
they would love that. Let's be honest. If you let the Royal Navy have that, though, then you might not have any other navies left by the end of the day, too.
And then you've got the Brain Coral submarine flagship. Okay,
again, the Royal Navy wouldn't say no to having it.
But, you're not supposed to admit that you're thinking along those lines. You're supposed to just show up out of nowhere, like something out of the third act of an action movie when all hope is lost. You know, when the carrier fleets are burning and the nuclear subs are running away and the aircraft are being shot out the sky and everybody's panicking, and then out of nowhere something, with rousing music and everything, this gigantic Brain Coral phaser-equipped shielded submarine pops up out of nowhere and calls down an orbital barrage of colonial Vipers. I mean, that's how we know the action movies end, directed by Roland B. Emmerich.
I would say
Michael Bay, because then there's more explosions, but at that point we'd have to have US flags fluttering everywhere, and this is a Royal Navy proposal.
Yeah. And let's be honest, this is the Royal Navy coming and saving the world after something's gone severely wrong. Again,
Something's gone severely wrong.
World of Tomorrow. The Royal
Navy budget.
It's Sky Captain and World of Tomorrow. There's a plucky American protagonist who is saved by the Royal Navy. technically, a Royal Navy flying aircraft carrier commanded by Commander Frankie Cook.
Which, to be honest,
Angelina Jolie,
in the realm of these particular set of slides, is probably one of the more sane things they could have proposed.
good lord!
Right.
Let's get on to our third topic before we torture the Royal Navy anymore and probably get ourselves banned from some of their bases.
So the last one is. What should the Philippines buy? Probably not this.
Well, this is actually a serious question, and it's going to sound strange to be brought up, but there is someone I follow on Twitter and occasionally has chatted back to me on Twitter, which is always nice when people do actually chat back to you and are friendly with you on Twitter, because it does help you learn things and study things and understand the things slightly more. And that is, of course, he's the current Philippines foreign minister, or definitely one of the ones senior involved in their work. And he's basically said, people have been asking why the Philippines Navy aren't involved in things. And he said, That's because we don't have the ships yet. You know, tell us what to buy. And this is Teddy Lockerson Jr., who said, we're still cobbling together something that can pass for a Navy or a Navy or a Navy let. Though sent one ship up to Hawaii for the big exercise. But, you know, it's basically in response to someone saying, strange that ages democracy, the Philippines, is afraid to stand up for free seas and sail the America. They're not afraid. They just don't have the Navy.
And to be honest, they don't have the budget for it because they've made significant increases in their budget, defense budget, in the past few years. But you're still talking about a yearly defense budget, even with the big increases, which will kick in next year, of about between $4 and $4.5 billion, which, okay, to you and me, to any sane individual, there's a lot of money. But on the scale of national defense, bearing in mind that that $4.5 billion has to cover everything, Army, Air Force, and Navy. So that even if you get an approximate one third split, at best, the Navy is going to get $1.5 billion.
So let's say if we were buying new ships for the Philippines, because that's honestly what they need. The trouble is they tend to buy older ships and recondition them, which does have its own problems. So let's see, in the budget, we're talking cheap frigates, which are still capable. So I'm trying to look around. Which are the programs we're talking about? MECOs?
Well, I'm just trying to think what's in the budget range, because from that $1.5 billion, you've got to obviously take off pay, maintenance, running costs, etc. All the stuff you usually have to pay for in a Navy, which means that your actual yearly budget for new acquisitions, I mean, even if you're being extremely generous and saying you can afford to spend a third of your budget on new acquisitions every year,
you can't. It's probably about, let's be honest, it's probably about a sixth.
Yeah, which would be about 250 mil.
Yeah.
And that's in dollars. So less than that in pounds.
That's 125 million pounds.
Yeah, 125, 150 mil. Like, what are you going to get for that?
Well, it's not going to be have to be a multi-year buy, isn't it?
Yeah, but then you're talking about multi-year buys for single vessels, which kind of, you know, now you see why they were buying old ships that people were basically just giving away.
Yeah.
I think this is the problem. Yes, the Philippines has a lot of people. Yes, it has a lot of land. Yes, it's very strategically positioned for what's going on at the moment. Not quite so much with the actual, you know, the money part of things.
Well, let's say this. To me, there are about two options sitting here. There's either America decides to supply constellations at cost, heavily subsidized cost.
Yeah, I was going to say. Because
they've got the production line going, and that's what they could conceivably do. That's one option. If they add on some more constellations to yards and they build them, that's one option. The other option is I'm looking at the cheapest frigate available at the moment, which is a Type 31.
It's about 250, and, just under 250.
Yeah, so about 2 years pay to get one frigate. And the thing is, would Britain subsidize that to an extent to have the Philippines, or rather would America maybe subsidize them buying it from Britain? Because again, Type 31 is a capable frigate that you would be happy to have in your task group, but it's also not so chock full of the latest, highest techest technologies that you're going to be. And I say this in the nicest way to Philippines, because I do think they are lovely and very hardworking people. But it's going to sound strange if they decide that actually, you know what, we would rather sit this one out. If you're missing some Type 31s from your firing line, you're not going to be so upset as if you have subsidized and built a load of constellations.
The constellations are half a billion dollar ships. So if we're talking about $150 million a year, and that's going to be their only naval acquisition at all,
for about 3 years.
Yeah, you're talking 3 to 3.5 years just to pay for one, and that's assuming you get that at cost, which, you know, okay, it's doable, but that means you get 3 ships a decade, which, and you're going to have to wait till the end of the decade to have all three, which is not really a force that anyone's going to be quaking in their boots over.
No.
And you cut, I mean, even the Type 31s at 250, just around about 250, but that's £250 million. So that's still 2 years, or so of funding. So at that point, 2 years, you can get five in a decade.
Yeah.
Which, okay, five is a little bit more than three, and you get them a lot sooner as well, because by year six, you have three instead of two, and then you get two more instead of one. So you see, the one problem I have with it is that the even the Type 31 being a relatively small vessel is still an oceanic combatant, and ultimately the Philippines doesn't have particularly much ambition to be doing a lot of overseas stuff, and any threat is either going to be coming to it or is going to be in relatively close proximity to it.
Okay.
So I would be tempted to actually scale things down a step further still and maybe actually look at large corvettes.
Are you talking about the Carif class sort of thing? Which are, but they're based on, these are of course famously based on the River class, and three of them were built for 400 million. They have a 76 millimeter Otto Melera gun. They have two 30 millimeters. They have 12 Mika SAMs and eight Exocets. They have one hangar and ability to carry a medium helicopter, and displace 2,600 tons. Top speed 28 knots, range 4,500 nautical miles, endurance 21 days, and require 100 crew.
Yeah, or you could even step down even further and look at something along the lines of a Visby class corvette, the one the Swedes have, because they are, if you're talking in well, they're about $180 billion, so you're talking about 120 million quid, which by our very rough estimates would be about one a year.
Yeah.
And you might be able to get some economies of scale out of that. Now, granted, the Visbys in and of themselves, some of their systems, that like the anti-sub and anti-aircraft missile systems, were cancelled, but you could put them back in again.
The trouble is they haven't been in construction since 2015, whereas the Carifs, they're based on the River class. So River class have been consistently in construction. They're a modification of the River class. That's the one advantage in terms of that they're slightly bigger. It's going to sound strange, though, but Visbys are lovely in terms of they are the secret attack. You have a couple of squadrons of those sitting around, and suddenly the Philippines goes from being a navy which the Chinese are probably fairly confident they can ignore to a navy that the Chinese are going, well, yeah, the trouble is they have stealth corvettes, so we will probably win, but we will get a bloody nose doing it.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, with the Philippines, you want to get as much bang for your buck as you possibly can, so I would actually notionally say that anything much over 1,000 tons is probably pushing the boat out a bit too far. Maybe you have a small frigate or two or three of several thousand ton corvettes as your, as I guess your flagship units for sailing around showing the flag, that kind of thing. But if you're having to go with small combatants in the first place, and your potential threat is something like China, you don't want to go with a few larger small combatants, if that makes sense, because that's just targets. You want to go with basically what can we get that's as small as possible, as cheap as possible, can be bought in as much numbers as possible, but still has a fairly nasty sting in its tail. And, you know, if you want to go down even a step further than the Visbys, you could look at the Skjolds, the Norwegian ones. Because the Visby's an 800 tonner. The Skjold is just under 300 tons. Now, admittedly, obviously, again, it's another step down. But in terms of overall capability, but it is also much, much cheaper, therefore can be built in larger numbers, and the Visbys and the Skolds are, they, I mean, they're designed to operate in the waters around those countries. So we are talking about still seagoing vessels, albeit you're now pushing down to the lower limits of things. But something along those lines would probably be, I would say, the better choice for the Philippines. And in fact, I would actually be more tempted to go with something along the size and scale of the Skolds rather than the Visbys. A, because you can get a lot more of them, and B, because they're ridiculously fast. In a calm sea, they can go up to 60 knots. And given the sheer size of the Philippines, and therefore their territorial waters, and the fact you're not going to, even at that scale, you're still not going to be able to afford massive numbers of vessels, you need something that can react as quickly as humanly possible over a long distance. And that kind of thing, it's that minimum viable force of, you know, if a big Chinese fishing fleet shows up, if you've got a flagship and one or two other units that can go 30, 35 knots, they might get there eventually, and they'll be big enough and scary enough to see them off. But really, you want to get rid of them before they can do major damage to your ecosystems, at which point having a bunch of small, still relatively heavily armed 60-knotters is quite useful, because one of them can be on the scene much more quickly. It's still a naval vessel, so they have to think twice about it. And if they do try anything, well, good luck trying to catch one. You could literally run circles around any kind of current Chinese ocean-going ship, whether it be a fishing boat, a Coast Guard boat, or an actual warship. At 60 knots, you can literally just be sailing donuts around them, and they can't do anything unless they're willing to open fire. And if they do, well, by the time they come to that decision, there's probably four of your friends have shown up, and you've all got, you know, an octet of anti-shipping missiles, which means anyone who tries to pull anything off is probably going to end up getting the wrong end of the stick.
And you've got four 76mm guns, and if you're at that range, you know. But I'm sitting here thinking and listening to you, and there's the part of me thinking, for war fighting, you're making the correct choice. And I would agree, I would go with the Skolds. But I suppose the reason I was sort of thinking the Type 31s and then the Kharif class, and I have to admit, I'm thinking about the Kharifs, and more and more I think them and the Skolds make sense. Because you also, if you're the Philippines, you need something you can persistently keep there. And as much as I love the Skolds, you'd wear them out by continually having to have them at sea as the presence. Whereas the Kharif, it's an OPV corvette, it's a bigger one, it can sit there. If you had three or four of those as the core of your fleet, if you needed a persistent presence in somewhere, you could maintain one of those there the whole time without any trouble, and then you could have your Skolds as your backup. And that would be actually a very flexible fleet and a very useful fleet for allies, because if you think about it, you could go, well, we can, if necessary, tag one of our corvettes into your task group. No one's going to complain about it being there. It's not going to be Aegis, whatever, and all those sort of things. But you can find a use for a Kharif class in a task group. You really can. Without too much work, you can find a use for something which is carrying anti-ship missiles, surface-to-air missiles, and has got a 76mm. You can find a use for it. What you can also find for the Philippines, it's be about being realistic about what they need. But also, I think one of the issues they've got currently is because they buy so many secondhand ships, those are very expensive to keep going. Secondhand ships, they're cheaper to buy, but they cost more to keep going. They cost more to maintain. And the other thing I've noticed about the discussions we've been talking about, we're talking about ships which have 100 crew, European. The Skolds, they have a complement of less than 20.
Mm-hmm.
If we look at the current Philippine Navy, their ships are mostly, and this is going to sound quite nasty, but no, it's not meant to be nasty, they are quite big, quite, how do I put this? They are ships which are, to an extent, quite big and sort of expensive to run. They've got the Jose Rizal class frigates, which were delivered in 2020, 2021. They're fitted for but not with a lot of systems, and they are built in South Korea. They are lovely, decent-sized frigates, but they have two of those, and that's all they've been able to afford.
Mm. Well, this is the thing where you have this balance, whereas the big navies have fleets of frigates and destroyers, and then they have a few larger vessels, if you're the US Navy, like Zumwalt's or Tycho's at the moment, and then you have your carriers as your centerpiece. For the Philippine Navy, you basically replicate that in miniature. So you have a frigate or two as your centerpiece. You have
Jose Rizal class. And then they've got this Fong class corvette, which is 1,200 tons, but they've only got one. And they're basically, they are retired from the Republic of Korea Navy.
Yeah, but
their former
you get your centerpiece ships. You maybe, if you can afford it, have two or three, several thousand ton, couple of thousand ton corvettes to float around, but they're not necessarily strictly needed. And then populate everything else with dozens of small two dozen man fast attack corvettes. So you've got the numbers.
What I love is I'm sitting here looking at these frigates, and the Jose Rivals, they have a complement of 65 plus attached crew. They displace 2,600 tons, so they're pretty much the same size as the Karif class, which we've been talking about. The Falun class are 1,200 tons, have a complement of 95. The Del Pilar class, which are some former US Coast Guard Hamilton class cutters, which they have three of, require 85 plus attached air crew and boarding team. Then you have the Jacinto class patrol vessels, which are former Peacock class patrol vessels, the Royal Navy's Hong Kong squadron, which they've got three, and they require a complement of 31 each. And then you've got the Melver class offshore patrol vessel, which is former Admiral class minesweepers, I think the Admiral class was sort of World War II. And they've got two of those, which are going to be retired before 2022 ends, but they have a complement of 85. They have an amphibious class landing, and they have the Telerik class landing platform dock, of which they have two, which are part of the Sealift Amphibious Force, which are 121 plus attached air crew and 500 Marines they can carry. They've got logistics support vessels, two of them, a former US Navy, I think. And again, complement 30 plus 150 Marines, various LSTs, one of which has been parked on a shoal as the protection of that shoal. This is what they're sort of having to do. They've got lots of these landing craft and things going around, which they obviously need for their various operations. They even have some Cyclone-class patrol ships from the US Navy, which they've got one of. And Kajin-class littoral patrol craft, which they've bought from Germany, which are...
You see, this is the problem. You're basically enunciating the problem. They've got ones and twos of everything, which is going to be driving their maintenance budget through the roof.
And this is the whole
minimal
thing
interoperability.
The first class I'm seeing more than ones and twos, I've got to the Jose Andarala class coastal patrol craft, which they ordered 22 units of, and they have a complement of 12, and these are definitely the vessels which are probably doing the bulk of the work for many reasons, but they only carry a single 25mm cannon. And some Browning machine guns. That's not really the deterrent that much. They've got some missile boats, which they've got from Taiwan. They've done a lot of work with them. And they've also bought some patrol craft from donated to them by the Chinese government, which look interesting. But that's going to add in more logistics nightmare. More landing craft. Again, at some point I have got to go to Wikipedia and explain that craft can never be crafts. There's no such thing as crafts. It's aircraft. It's a single craft or multiple craft. landing crafts does not mean what they think it means. I'm sorry. There's no S. I don't
unless
care.
They're doing woodwork and embroidery as they're on their way to the beach.
Yeah. Then there's just no. And then it gets even worse when you look at the aircraft and you sit there and think, I'm sitting here looking at the Philippines and I feel sorry for the logistics officers. I feel really sorry. Although I do love that they have the 40mm twin gun. They have twin 40mm. They're not banging around. On the Poang class, they have a twin 40mm. They also have a super rapide 76mm on their Jose Rizal class. So they are making good choices. They're just not getting much for it. Because they have so much. It's almost looking like at a smorgasbord of everything. And the missile systems, it's the smorgasbord of everything. And they are planning on future ships. They are planning on buying apparently some Scorpion class submarines off the French.
Well, the French submarine yards are going to have a few vacancies.
They want to buy two more corvettes of the Jose Rizal class, which is very good. I can understand buying it from South Korea, and that's a good design. They do need more. They do need two. But then you sort of go through the list, and they're buying more Cyclone class patrol vessels from the U.S. Navy, more some offshore patrol vessels from the Australians. Some fast interdiction craft, missile craft from the Israelis. And they want to buy a landing platform dock from the Indonesians. Now, again, I can understand that they are, for their budget, they are getting masses out of us. We have to give them huge kudos for that. But I also want to go through their procurement people and start going, what are you on? You know, okay, you fine. You've got the Jose Rizal class, which are new ships. That's good. Keep that. You're planning on getting Israeli fast attack craft. If that's what you want, going with a Mediterranean fast attack craft design instead of Scholes, fine. I accept that. But then let's start cutting down all these designs. Let's start paring down, because you're going to make your logistics and everything a lot easier if you cut the stuff down, because you're going to make your life a lot easier in terms of deployability, in terms of getting your forces moving, if you can pare down, have more of less. And the trouble is they are a poor nation, so they have, in terms of their actual funding ability to fund defense at the moment, so they've been forced into a scenario where they have got what they've been able to get when they could get it. And this has put them in a bad situation. And it's just that the Jose Rizal class, they are lovely looking vessels. They are modified variations of the ROK's Navy's Incheon class. They are built by Hyundai Heavy Industries, and they cost I think it's nearly 8 billion pesos, 8 billion Philippine pesos per unit. So the Philippines are prepared to spend a lot of money on defense. But they need more.
Yeah. Well, as I say, a lot of it is reminding me very much of the late 1890s Royal Navy in miniature, where you've got this interesting and increasingly geriatric collection of relics that are costing a fortune to keep going because they're all pretty much bespoke, with a relatively small handful of much more modern unified class units coming online, and you know. They kind of need a Philippine version of Admiral Fisher to just roll in and say, no, th- this is stupid. All this old, broken down, secondhand stuff that we have in ones and twos doesn't work. We're just going to scrap the lot of it and use the money that we've saved on our increased defense budget to consolidate around two or three classes, at least one of which should be small enough for us to buy in mass numbers. That would be my take on it. Because at the end of the day, no matter how many ships you buy of whatever size and shape on the budget that the Philippines has, they're never going to be in a position where they can meaningfully go out to sea as a deep ocean navy to take on enemies far away. They are going to be a local force, not a coastal defense force, but a local defense force for Philippine interests in and around the Philippine holdings. And for that, you know, if the enemy's big enough to come at you with aircraft carriers, then you need to find somebody who's an ally who's got aircraft carriers of their own, because you're not going to be able to afford to counter them directly. And if they're not coming at you with aircraft carriers, well, at that point, you know, large numbers of small ships armed with a surprisingly impressive battery of surface-to-surface missiles will make most people back off, because apart from anything else, you know, it doesn't matter if someone, if China sends a Type 055 and the Philippines comes out with four Scold derivatives, you know, yes, okay, the Type 055 could probably sink them all, but you can guarantee if your fleet of Scold derivatives lobs three dozen anti-shipping missiles at close range at the 055, that 055 is going down as well. And I can guarantee you an 055 costs a heck of a lot more than a quartet of Scolds. Assuming that they even hit the blasted things, considering the Scolds will probably be zipping around like Speedy Gonzales.
Doing their best impression of, can you see us? Can you not?
Mm.
And also, hang on, it depends how close again they are, because if a Scold is a smaller ship, so it probably has the missile set to go off quite closer to it and acquire closer to it. But if you're a larger ship, you might well have your missile set to not target till they're further away. In which case, the Scolds might be too close.
Well, I have to see.
Okay, right. So before we finish, I would like to say one more thing. Am I the only one who's seen the recent adverts for a new 007 movie and gone, you have literally gone and got the villains, everything, including the Aston Martin car, out of the museum to use just to try and make this movie sell?
I haven't seen the trailer yet, to be honest. The only trailer I've seen recently is Dune. I mean, to be fair, 007 in Dune would be quite amusing, or possibly Sandworm showing up in a James Bond movie.
Check your Twitter. I have just sent it to you now. Yes, have a look at this. Have a look at this. It is, I mean, literally, they have got the old DB7 out and have put a Vulcan cannon in it. Admittedly, I want that car now, but didn't you used to just have a single machine gun in there?
I can't remember back that far.
But it is—it's a very interesting commentary. We have that currently going on, and I can also announce that there are people actually on Twitter now making a joke about how Australia isn't a real place, so this is all a made-up treaty.
No, that's Finland. I can't say that anymore because I've now been to Helsinki. Unless that was a dream.
Was a dream, a very, very disturbed dream.
Oh well.
Take care, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed. I'm going to aim to get this up today after recorded, so I'm going to have to quickly do it all before then recording some videos and before doing a live this evening. Thank you very much, everyone. We're going to have to wish Drac good luck because he's making me very jealous. He's managing to go to Tank Fest this weekend and have a lot of fun.
Hopefully meet a few subscribers.
He's going to be there on Saturday. And we also got something else we can announce. On the 26th, we're both going to be on HMS Belfast, aren't we?
I think so, yes. Yes, 26th.
on the 26th, and that's I think that's being hosted to an extent by Wargaming, isn't it? Or I'm not quite sure. I know I got invited and someone said the words free tickets to Matrix Belfast, and it was basically I lost track of anything else set out to that point. I'm just going,
assuming it's not chucking it down with rain, I will probably set up camp somewhere near the forward guns.
And I might be pickable out because I might be wearing a bright orange t-shirt that day. Mm-hmm. Who knows?
Right. All right. See you all later.
Thanks. Bye. Bye.
Welcome to the Bilge Pumps, where a bunch of naval geeks spout off.